Welcome back, everybody, to the Egg Aviator Podcast. This is episode number 4. I'm sitting down with Michael Rutledge today. He is a former Navy SEAL and special operations pilot that decided to become an egg pilot. So we're going to hear about his military experience today, talk about his journey as an egg pilot, and a little bit of advice he has for folks that are trying to get into the industry. With that, the Egg Aviator Podcast spools up now. Before I get into quizzing Mike, I got to talk a little bit about our sponsor. You heard from him in the last episode, number 3, from Travis Sam. His company's called American Designs. That's Alpha Mike Bravo, E-R-I-C-A-N. And Travis is just like me. He went to the YouTube Academy of CAD drawing. He learned how to draw parts for air tractors. He started 3D printing them, and he is now turning them out in anodized aluminum. So if you're looking for some air tractor steps, mirrors, visors, etc., you can hop on over to his website, americandesigns.com, and check that out. He's in the process of building the one-stop shop for online egg aviation parts. He's got a few other companies on there. Go over and check him out. That's Alpha Mike Bravo, E-R-I-C-A-N-Designs.com. And I got Michael Rutledge with me today. Mike, how you doing?
Good morning, Andy. Doing just fine.
Good to hear. Thanks for taking the time to sit down with me and share your knowledge and experience with everyone. So to start off, why don't we go into a little bit on your background, you know, where you came from and how you got the aviation bug?
Well, I'll kind of see if I can pack the last 40 years in a couple of usable minutes. I grew up in a little town of Galesburg, Illinois, and kind of grew up in a flying family. My dad had antique airplanes. He had a J3 Cub, and he had a Stearman. Coincidentally, the same Stearman that I own now, that I bought back 30 years after he passed. And I grew up in Galesburg, and dad passed away when I was 12, so we bounced around a couple different locations in the Midwest, and did one unsuccessful year of college, played football in college at Iowa State University, and was unsuccessful and ended up enlisting in the Navy. Did a couple years as a helicopter, a CH-46 crew chief and rescue swimmer, so I flew quite a bit and also turned a lot of wrenches. And then kind of a bigger story in and of itself, but then I saw these guys with big muscles and wavy blonde hair walk by me one day, and that was the whole catalyst. I'm like, oh, I think I want to be a Navy SEAL. So I went to a basic underwater demolition school, BUDS, in 1993, and spent about 10 years in the SEAL teams, both at SEAL Team 1, and then about 3 years as an instructor in various different roles. And then I was a team leader when 9/11 happened in 2001, and saw these black unmarked helicopters that we're working on and flying with. And like everything else, I kind of decided, well, how do I get that job? It's a much deeper story than that, but long story short, I transferred in 2002. I transferred over to the Army to go to flight school as a warrant officer, and did that. And upon graduation from flight school, went direct to the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment, which is headquartered at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. And, you know, if you've seen the movies Black Hawk Down or Zero Dark 30 or 12 Strong or any of that. Anyway, so I spent the next 14 years at the 160th straight, did 16 combat deployments to the various garden spots in the Middle East. And then in 2016, from there, to finish out my 30-year career, I went 3 years as a commander of the Executive Flight Detachment at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, which was definitely a pinnacle assignment. And so somewhere in there, as it applies to ag aviation, about 8 or 9 years ago, I've been working on it for 20 years, but about 8 or 9 years ago, I got my first shot to break into the ag aviation industry, flying a Pawnee and a 301 for Harley Curlis in Astoria, Illinois, Curlis Flying Service. Harley ended up transitioning me to a 502 and a 602. And then Harley gave me the opportunity to go work for a gentleman named Ralph Lutz in Indiana, Shipshewan, Indiana, line of 502. And Ralph was considering transitioning out of the business. And so I worked for Ralph for a couple seasons. And then when I finally retired from the Army, moved to Indiana full time to work with Ralph. And that's about it.
Awesome. That was about 3 minutes and 30 seconds. You got all those years packed in there. So,
yeah, that's the broad strokes.
Yep. So, well, let's dive into that a little bit more. So you said that you graduated high school, you went and you tried the college football thing, wasn't working out for you. So you decided to choose a career in the military. So why did you first decide to join the military?
Well, the military had actually always been my plan. Everybody in my family was old for whatever reason. So I had lots of World War II men that would frequent around the house with my dad. There was lots of Korea vets. I mean, it was just the era where everyone had served in one capacity or another. So I had never considered anything other than having a career in the military. I guess for whatever reason, you know, I never wanted to be a doctor or a lawyer or anything else, any other occupation. All I knew was that I was going to end up in the military. I didn't know exactly what I was going to do, but I knew I was going to wear a uniform. And, you know, having vintage World War II airplanes around the house and having that influence kind of piqued my interest in history. And of course, you can't get into the military airplanes history without getting into military history. And one thing led to another. So that was just kind of, it was very, very linear and focused. And I think that's just what I'd always planned on doing. So I definitely took the circuitous route. I'd kind of kidded myself and thought that maybe I had what it takes to go to a military academy, which the academy recruiters were very proactive in letting me know that I most certainly did not. you know, so I'm a bit of a mouth breather, knuckle dragger. So it all turned out very well, but I'd always planned on having a career in the military. And there's not one single thing that I regret about that 30 years, except perhaps, you know, the time away from family. But I got to do and see things that no kid that barely graduated from high school should ever be allowed to do. It was a great career. Like I said, it takes a toll on several other parts of your life, but just the things that you get to experience are priceless.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your service and dedication. It's definitely an exciting and extensive career that you had. So when you first joined the military, I believe you had the intention of becoming a Navy pilot, correct?
I did. That was pretty naive, again, considering that I barely graduated high school and failed several classes, but you know, at that age, you don't know how dumb you are. So, So yes, I did have that intent. Again, almost another story in and of itself. After the Naval Academy recruiter told me that not only was I not suited for the Naval Academy, he was quite certain that I didn't have what it takes to even be in the military at all in any capacity. So what's a guy do after that? He just goes down the Navy recruiter and enlists. But, yep. Being of the fresh off the Top Gun era, of course, I went in like everyone else. I'm like, oh, I want to be a Navy pilot and yep. Fly off carriers. And I got completely lied to because I was young and naive. And the recruiter told me, he's like, hey, so, you know, you don't have a degree, so I can't put you in flight school. But I'll make you a helicopter crew chief. And that's almost the same thing as being a pilot. You know, the pilot has to ask you when to start. So I fell for it. Yep. Hook, line, and sinker. And so instead of launching and catapulting and recovering on the carrier, you know, I find myself in Desert Storm a year and a half later, just flying around on CH-46 helicopters around the Persian Gulf, delivering pallets of cheese balls and soda and mail back and forth to ships. So that's how I spent Desert Storm. So I was a little bit bitter, which probably accelerated my search for something else interesting to do.
That kind of right there just leads us into the next thing. So while you're delivering the cheese balls and soda, you run across these guys that I guess fed that fire in your stomach about trying to find somebody else. And from there you decided to pursue a career as a Navy SEAL.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's getting a little bit off the topic of ag aviation, but it's a pretty interesting story in that, this day and age, Navy SEALs are kind of the flavor of the month and, you know, just a lot in the media about them. But back in that day, back in, you know, 91, 92, you didn't know anything about them. All there were a couple books, you know, from their exploits in Vietnam. So, you know, hate to say it, but that was for the age of the internet. And, you know, so if you could find some printed material, it was pretty rare. So a lot of it was just sort of legend and tribal lore and stuff like that. But I was stationed in Guam. The unit, the squadron I was at was in Guam, and there was a Naval Special Warfare unit there. which had seals, and they'd pop up subtly every once in a while. And so one day, one of our helicopters was flying some seals around. They were doing water parachute jumps or something like that. And after my, I think it was like my 12th or 13th hour of flying, and I was sitting in the hangar wrenching on an engine, and here's some of these guys off the back of the helicopter, you know, no shirts, just wearing swimming trunks and carrying fins. And, you know, the Navy was fairly rigid at that time, and big muscles and long hair. I'm like, holy cow, who are those guys? Mm-hmm. And so somebody just said, these guys are Navy SEALs. I'm like, well, I don't know who they are, but if they're in our Navy, I want to do that job. Whatever that job's doing, that's way better than what I'm doing, because my job sucks. Yeah. So at that point, I was a bit of an opportunist, but there was no chest beating. You know, it wasn't like it is now where you have guys, you know, saying, well, I've always wanted to be a SEAL since I was five. And there was like none of that. I just knew whatever I was doing at that time was pretty menial and sucked. And I was sweaty and unhappy and uninspired. And here come these guys that look like they worked out for 5 hours a day and had great suntans and all that. So, mm-hmm. So I would love to say that I had more of a patriotic inspiration. But that's pretty much it. And the rest is kind of history as far as that goes. I just happened to be a little hard nosed and made it work.
Right. How you became a Navy SEAL and even a SOAR pilot for that matter, just from what I've researched on your career, is that what do we tell young guys all the time? It's like, if you want a job, go bang on doors. And you were more than willing to do whatever it took to go move on to that next step, be it a Navy SEAL or a SOAR pilot.
Well, yeah. And I will say, on a mentorship note on that, is that the only parallel I have is a military, where there's guys like myself who say, hey, I completely took the government for a ride and I got everything I wanted. I had a great time. I got to experience everything. And then you talk to some guys who are like, well, my 4 years sucked and, you know, I completely got screwed and it's all political. And I know there's some exceptions, but I largely believe that you sort of create your own fortune.
Yeah.
You know, if it sucks 9 times out of 10, it's because you let it happen to you, or you weren't proactive, or you just took, you know, you took a no when maybe you'd have been a little more persistent, you could have found a yes.
Right.
And I know that sounds kind of idealistic, but looking back over that many years, I can say that there were dozens and dozens and dozens of times where someone told me no, and I just said, okay, I'll move on. You know, but I didn't. I just ended up going to find somebody who said yes instead of the one guy who was triggered to say no.
Right.
So I believe you create your own fortune.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll fast forward again. You spent quite a few years in the SEALs. Like you said, you got to, well, you rode with the 160th quite a bit, correct, in your Navy SEAL career?
That's correct.
You had your passion for aviation already, and you had been working with these guys, and you really wanted to become a 160th pilot. So you end up getting into the warrant officer flight program. So can you tell us a little bit about what flight experience exactly, you know, did you have going into that flight officer program? You know, I know you had your license and you talked about doing some flying in your off duty time. So what kind of experience did you have at that point?
Well, I mean, I'll back it up a little bit in that I knew just a couple years after I'd gotten to the SEAL teams, I honestly knew that I wanted to be an ag pilot. Mm-hmm. And we're talking like 96 or 7, something like that, like that long ago.
Okay.
I knew that's what I wanted to do. And at that point, I had enough maturity. You know, I was married. I just got married. And I knew at that point that, you know, I was smart enough to know that you had to build a career to be able to be an ag pilot. So my plan, and it's changed a dozen times since then, my plan was, all right, well, I've got 4 years left on this enlistment. I'm going to get out, you know, because we were just getting ready to think about having kids and stuff. I'm going to get out and I'm going to go to Imperial Valley, California and be an ag pilot.
Yep.
That was my plan. So I knew that you had to have a lot of tailwheel time. So I went and got my own private license. You know, I went and got my own commercial. And I mean, I was paying for this all myself. Mm-hmm. Before we had our first child. And, you know, I went and rented a Champ for $41 an hour and banged around the pattern for 2 hours a day, every day, and until I couldn't stand it anymore, because you weren't allowed to take it out of the traffic pattern. And so I knew that, you know, I didn't know anything about the industry, but I knew as a base, you had to have tailwheel time. And so
Then
I went and got I was actually skydiving at, in Elsinore, California. And the SEAL teams would give us jump tickets every week. You could go out and just jump for free for proficiency at the civilian drop zone. I looked over and there's these Pawnees and Call Airs towing gliders. So instead of jumping, you know, I walked next door. I'm like, hey, I've got a private license and like 200 hours, and tail, you know, 20 hours of tailwheel. how do I get a job towing gliders? Because I was running out of money. And the gentleman who's now since been passed, he invited me back out the next weekend. And so I started towing gliders. And that was, to date, probably the best experience I've ever had to prepare you for ag flying. Because one, I had a private license, and it was the only place you could tow or fly a big airplane like that, basically for compensation without having a commercial. And I was getting, 20 or 30 takeoffs and landings a day out in this desert dirt strip with tailwind landings and tailwind takeoffs.
Yep.
And it was gusty and all that and slow. And I was flying an ag plane. So for me at that point in my life, I might as well have been flying a P-51. It was that meaningful.
Yeah.
So that's how I kind of got some of the bulk of my experience. And then through that, I volunteered at a museum in San Diego. And by this time I'd had a commercial. And I had a partnership in a T-34, and I say a partnership, it wasn't like I contributed money to it, but I did all the maintenance and worked on it and stuff, and the owner basically let me fly it for whenever I wanted for gas. So I built a couple hundred hours doing that, and that was a good time. And then from there, I started getting a little bit of reputation in the Southern California warbird community. And so that built, people always ask, well, how did you get into all the warbird stuff? And so it starts with, one guy saying, hey, I've got this, whatever, this L4 Cub, can you ferry it over here? And then the next guy calls and says, hey, I've got a Stearman, can you move it over here? And that guy calls another guy, and he needs a T6 ferried or moved or something like that. And so that kind of all the way up to flying T28s, and so that kind of worked out for me, and that's how I started getting most of my heavy tailwheel time and experience doing that. And to this point, I had still always planned on getting out and going to be an ag pilot. So then 9/11 hits. Well, before that, we have a kid. So now, like everyone else, life happens. And I'm like, okay, full well knowing that I'm going to have to load for a season or two, making peanuts, but learning the craft. I was kind of prepared to do that. But then 9/11 hits and we have a kid. And obviously the occupation I was in gets immensely busy after 9/11. So I kind of had put that on hold. So there goes my 4 or 5 year plan. And then my wife was a federal parole officer at the time, and little did I know that her income was actually supporting us. My silly little enlisted salary was basically paying for all my fun flying and paying some utilities. So we made the mutual decision when we had our first son, who's now 20, when we had him, that she would stay home and keep the family together, which was absolutely the right decision. Mm-hmm. But then I realized, like 75% of our income went away. So there went all the renting airplanes and having fun and all that. So I had to find a real job. I didn't have enough flying time. I probably had like 500 or 600 hours, and a commercial, and I didn't have enough time to get into ag, nor did I plan ahead enough to be able to get out of the military. Cause at that point, when you got a wife and kid and liabilities, it's kind of somewhat of a gravy train.
Right.
So, so I tried to get a Navy flight school at that point, and they're like, "Yeah, you're too old. Cause cut off is 27. So I really needed a flying job, or else I wasn't going to get to fly anymore. And then, after 9/11, I ran into the 160th SOAR guys, overseas. And, I said, "Hey, how do I get your job? I want to fly Army helicopters." I mean, there's various reasons for that, but it was going to be the most direct and fastest route to getting a flying job in the military, which is the world I was familiar with, is the language I spoke. So anyway, they gave me kind of the road to how to do that. And, I just put in the application, and again, there's a story within a story about that whole process, but I put in an application, and then June of 2002, as soon as I got back from our first deployment after 9/11, I had orders waiting for me to transfer over to the Army, go down to Fort Rucker, Alabama, and start flight school. So one day I was in the Navy, and the next day I went down and signed a piece of paper, and I was in the Army, and trucked my family from San Diego, California, down to Fort Rucker, Alabama, July 1st, 2002, and we were in. So that's how the Army life started. But I had quite a bit of civilian flight time. I mean, it wasn't casual. I wasn't just banging on in a 172. I mean, I'd had flight time,
Yeah, you'd actually
T-6s. Yeah, I mean, I'd actually gotten an FAA formation rating, like a wingman and a lead rating. So, I mean, I was actually flying air shows and stuff. A relatively low time, but I had some really, really great mentors that spent a lot of time with me. So I wasn't out there teaching myself.
Yeah.
Took gliders, took banners, but at that point I really knew that I wanted to be an ag pilot. Again, talk about some sticking to it. That was 20 years before I ever actually got in a revenue paying ag plane, but I knew that's what I wanted to do. So if it wasn't a tailwheel airplane, I wasn't interested.
Right.
And, you know, that was kind of the bottom line. So I'm sort of like a dog with a bone.
Right. Can you talk a little bit about your training that you did prior to being deployed at the 160th, you know, the machines you flew and what you did?
Yeah, I had never fancied myself a helicopter pilot. I never even thought about the possibility, you know, because all I ever wanted to do was fly fighters or ag planes or whatever. But I knew that that was the only way I was going to get paid to fly at that particular hour. It was the quickest. It was the quickest way to do it. You know, it was a solution to the problem that I needed to solve at the time. Again, with a wife and a new child, and you know, liabilities and all that kind of stuff. So I wasn't a kid at this point. I was probably 29 or 30, I think.
Yep.
But I got in the Army and transferred to Army flight school, and I thought I'd died and gone to heaven, because now instead of me renting airplanes or, you know, eking out 0.5 at a time, you know, I was flying a Huey in primary and instruments. I started out in a Jet Ranger, and then I was flying a Huey for 4 hours a day, you know, 5 days a week, and they were actually paying me for it. So that was quite a departure. You know, that was truly my first paying flying job, I think, to speak of. Because now it was a profession. You know, before it was kind of like a hobby or something I was doing on the side, but now it'd become a profession.
Right.
And that was kind of cool. But I flew a little bit of Jet Ranger. I got rated in a Huey. Flew a Huey for several months, and then I transitioned into UH-60 Blackhawk, which I flew for like 80 or 90 hours. Mm-hmm. And then I flew a CH-47. I got rated in that, and then I went up to the 160th Camp Kentucky, and I flew an MH-47. Chinook, which is a special operations variant of the Chinook. It's vastly different. It looks similar on the outside, but all the mission equipment and the fuel systems and armament and weapons and all that kind of stuff is vastly, vastly different. And it's black and unmarked, which is kind of cool. Mm-hmm. And I also flew an MH-6, which is a militarized assault or gunship version of an MD-500 helicopter. And then a little bit later in my career, then I also flew an Airbus. They call it UH-72 Lakota, but basically it's just an Airbus helicopter painted green with executive interior. That's what we had at West Point. And then I did go on to fly some fixed wing for the Army as well, various versions of the King Air and Pilatus Porter. So I got to fly a pretty diverse amount of stuff. I was developmental test pilot for a period of time while I was at the 160th. So I got to do lots of test and development on both hardware and software stuff, and kind of introduced the true Rockwell Collins glass panel technology to the regiment. And I had a bunch of other collateral duties. I was a safety, like a battalion safety officer, which is kind of like a corporate safety guy. You know, we had 25, 26 helicopters, and I was responsible for that. I also did a fair amount of instructing. I was an instructor pilot on the side and an examiner, so I could certify other instructors. So within that time, I kind of was able to move around in lots of different positions, basically just satisfy my curiosity so I didn't get stagnant and bored. But there was always something to do, and this is all in between, you know, in between deployments. We were doing 90 days on, 90 days off, or 60 on, 60 off from, you know, 2002 when I got there all the way till 2016 when I left. So when I say I was doing all these things, they're always in between deployments and always in between training trips, were anywhere from a week to 3 weeks in between those 60 days when you're home. So it was really rewarding, but it was pretty arduous. And talking about sacrifices, trying to get into ag, you know, I picked the Midwest, Illinois in particular, because that's where I'm from. And I'd always, you know, daydreamed about when I retire, it'd be really nice to go back home and spray. Mm-hmm. So when I hooked up with Harley Curlis through, you know, that was a chain of events. I got handed off from two or three different mentors until I finally got to Harley, you know, because the Midwest fungicide rush, which, you know, everybody calls the corn run, but really it's just when the greatest amount of acres have to be sprayed in the shortest amount of time. And that's the run that everyone refers to. You know, as a seasonal guy, you can do 6 weeks and get the bulk of it. So those 60 off deployments, for the last 5 years of my military career, I would take all my friends, I would bribe them, and I would take all of their Thanksgiving and Christmas deployments, which means I would be gone every Thanksgiving and every Christmas. And I would take their deployments for them so I could have that 6 months of summer off, because everyone wants summer off. You know, so basically I would have to sacrifice all my big family holidays and then my vacation time, which I should have been spending with my family and my growing sons You know, I spent in Illinois or Indiana in an ag plane, you know, and my family was really, really sweet and understanding about it. But, you know, make no mistake that, you know, I basically gave up the last 5 years of my kids' lives and family's life. So no Christmas, no Thanksgiving, and no summer break to be an ag pilot. So, you know, I guess I kind of have a reputation as a fairly straight shooter, but, you know, when guys talk to me about, well, I don't know if I can do this or that, I probably have less sympathy than anybody, just because, you know, while I did have an interesting and storied career, some people make the mistake that I kind of had it easy, but yeah. I mean, I may have not had to make monetary sacrifices, but, you know, I certainly had to make sacrifices that most other people aren't willing to do. And I made that in the form of family time, you know, for 5 or 6 years, just to get to the point where I could make it a full-time career that we could live on.
That's a really great point to make about sacrifice. You know, even myself, I mean, I'm only 24. I haven't had to sacrifice too much. I say that I sacrificed, you know, being away from my fiance and family for a while, but I was fortunate to do that at probably the least stressful point in my life, I guess. I think people need to ask themselves, you know, if you're not getting where you want to, especially in your ag aviation career, I think the first place to start is, well, am I sacrificing enough? Am I putting enough on the table to convince this guy that I'm worth starting?
Well, you know, Matt P, George Parker, I mean, we're all kind of in the same circle, and we talk to each other a lot on the topic of mentorship and preparation. And I am certainly no Jedi Knight, because I haven't been an ag for 20 years. And that, you know, I mean, there's a lot of things that I haven't seen. But through the military career and all the stuff I've done, one thing that I understand clearly, probably better than most in the industry, is preparation to succeed, you know, because everything I've ever done in the military, there was no tolerance whatsoever for failure. So what I ended up mastering, and a great skill that I brought forward to ag and fire and stuff like that, is I know how to draw a roadmap, you know, and come up with a plan to make sure that 100% no fail, I succeed at what I'm setting out to do, you know. And I do the same thing for other people. We're like, hey, how do I do this? I'll draw them a plan. I'm like, all right, here's the deal. Here's your 4 year, here's your 5 year plan. If you follow this, I 99.9% guarantee you will get hired, you know, from zero time. I guarantee it. It's up to you whether or not, you know, if you don't want to put in the effort to it, you don't want to make sacrifice, I can't help you with that. But, you know, here's literally a written plan that will get you where you want to go. Cause I know how to do that. I know how to make sure that things succeed. You know, but we're all in that same circle of mentorship, and a lot of guys just aren't willing. You know, they say, I really want to be an ag pilot, and, you know, you'll put to them, okay, well, if you'll be an ag pilot, here's what you have to do. And it's not paying dues, you know, it's not enduring the suck just to see if you can do it.
Right.
I refer to it as you just have to learn the craft like any other profession, because that's what it is. It's not a job, it's a profession. And right. And a lot of people don't realize it's not only a profession, it's a lifestyle. Mm-hmm. You know, it completely engulfs every facet of your life. It's, as everyone knows, it's more like farming than it is aviation. You know, airline pilots, they take off their epaulets and they close the door at the end of the night, and it's not that way for ag pilots or farming. Nope. So that's my thoughts on it.
Let's kind of fast forward now. So you went and worked for the 160th for quite a while. From there, you went to West Point, and then when you finished with your job at West Point, I mean, you really could have probably gotten a job doing whatever you wanted to with the extensive career that you had. So you had been involved in ag aviation so far, and you just decided you were going to stick with that and keep moving forward with ag.
Well, yeah. And so one of the things is that all the stuff that the guys search for, you know, the whole adrenaline rush and all that, like, I got all that out of my system. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's still a little bit left in there, but, you know, searching for how far can you push yourself and all that, and doing stupid stuff in an aircraft, you know, stuff that will almost get you killed. I got all that out of my system, and, I'm probably one of the more conservative ag pilots you'll see or fly with, just cause not to be, you know, too emotional about it, but I've been close to death enough in aircraft for stuff that had nothing to do with my control that, I made a state one time. I'm like, you know, I've kind of seen all this, and I'm sure as hell not going to die in an ag plane spraying corn in Illinois or Iowa.
Right. Yeah.
You know, like, I have that perspective. So I'm productive, but I'm safe, and I don't take unnecessary risks. You know, as I refer to it, as stuffing the rabbit in the hat. So I'm 99.9% sure of the outcome of anything that I do, because I've kind of planned it and done the mental math and the risk mitigation and all that. So, but why did I pursue ag? I made a decision a long time ago, and I don't remember when it is, but it was easily 15 years ago or 20 years ago or so. Is, you got to remember, I grew up with World War II airplanes and, you know, big tail oil airplanes. And somewhere in that decision-making process, you know, I knew that I wanted to follow on career in aviation. And if anybody knows me, you know, my temperament is most definitely not suited for the corporate world or airlines. I'm not even sure I would make it through training. They would bounce me out immediately. Not that I don't have the skill for it. I just don't have the temperament for it.
Yep.
You know, and like I said, I kind of, that sort of structure, oddly enough, after all the military, I think I just had enough. So
yep.
I knew that I wanted to fly big tail airplanes for a living. And somewhere in my brain, it registered. I'm like, well, the only place that you can go fly big tail airplanes for a living and get paid for it is in ag. Mm-hmm. And that was true. You know, I mean, ag is the very last bastion. You know, where largely it's not automated. The outcome and or the successful outcome is based on pure pilot skill and intuition and work ethic and all that. And I'm not sure you find that in any other segment of aviation anywhere in the world.
No.
I mean, people say there's some stuff, you know, whatever. There's pipeline, there's fire, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, other places where you fly relatively close to the ground. But I don't know of any other place in aviation, you know, where it's a single cockpit. You're making all the decisions, you know, not even flying a fighter. Because you're guided by a very, very stringent set of rules and regulations and codes of conduct and all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
Ag aviation is the only place I know of where you are sole control of the airplane and the outcome, and that you get to fly in those sort of parameters. So I'm sure my thoughts about it at the time were less complex, mm-hmm. But I appreciate it even more now than I did then. So I knew that's what I wanted to do, and I knew that's where my temperament was, and, like everyone else, I'm not convinced that I don't have some little childhood ADHD issues or whatever, because I cannot sit still for very long. And the thought of sitting in an automated cockpit for hours and hours on end, I don't even care if it pays $500,000 a year. It would make me absolutely batty. So like, this is a job for me, and I never consider anything else once I set my mind to it. And once I started doing it full time, I can honestly say I've not been disappointed for one second of it. You know, after one 16 or 17 hour day in the airplane, there was never one time I woke up at 4:30 the next morning and thought, Christ, I don't want to go get back in the cockpit. You know, there hasn't been one day in the 8 years I've been doing it, or 8 or 9 years I've been doing it, there hasn't been one single day that I didn't want to go back to work, you know, and get in the ag plane again. Mm-hmm. Now, I can tell you plenty of those days where I was driving to work to go get in the helicopter, I got a knot in my stomach, or I was like, I'd love to take the day off or something like that. So I have zero regrets about my decision to be an ag pilot. It was worth every single sacrifice, and I'll be happy to do it until I really retire.
Is there a little bit of an interesting story that somebody could maybe take something away from on how you broke into the industry, or was it, you know, pretty straightforward, just did the loading for a couple years and then somebody started you?
Yes, it was kind of an interesting story. But if you remember back when I said, I just make sure I'm the master at making sure that I get 100% success when I decide to do something. Mm-hmm. And that's not because I'm a really smart guy. I'm just a really hard guy and I don't quit. But when I decided I wanted to be an ag pilot, and I didn't really know anybody, but, you know, I set the plan out 5 years ahead of time. Okay, I need whatever I had in my mind. I need 500 hours of tailwheel time, and the heavier aircraft, the better. So every decision I made, it was, you know, if the guy had a Champ, I'm like, hey, you know anybody with Satabria? And if he had a Satabria, I'm like, hey, you know anybody that has a BT-13? You know, and if I flew a BT-13, I was like, hey, you know anybody who's got a T-6? And so it's very opportunistic, but I knew that more tailwheel time I had, and the heavier tailwheel time I had, and the more diverse range of airplanes I got to fly, I knew that that would enhance my chances of being an attractive prospect for somebody to break in. So, I mean, I was deliberate, like to a fault. And when I got closer to having the qualifications and I was actually ready to start approaching someone in the industry about breaking in, you know, I had it in my mind. I'm like, all right, I'm going to do absolutely everything I can possibly do. So whoever I approach, they can't say no. Like, they can't look at me and look at my resume and say, there's no way I can say no to this guy.
Yep.
So, you know, by the time I approached Harley, and there's a story in that, and I'll back up a little bit. The first guy I went to was a gentleman named Tom Mills in Imperial Valley, California, because I was stationed in California at the time. And he and I became good friends, and he is a longtime ag pilot, since retired. and he and I had been friends, and I kind of consulted him. And this is, you know, when I had a private license and 100 hours and 10 hours of champ time. And he referred me to Rick Reed in Mattoon, Illinois, who's a longtime Midwest ag operator. And Rick was going to hire me, and I ended up getting stuck in a stop loss, and I couldn't get out. And then before I could retire from the Army to switch over, he retired, and he handed me over to Carly Curlis.
Okay.
So the quick lesson between the head is the first person you meet is not necessarily the one you're going to work for.
Right.
Everybody knows everybody in the industry. And if you have a good reputation and they think you're worthy of their time, you will get handed off two or three times from mentor to mentor. And one of those will be the one, you know, where you'll build your nest.
Yep.
So by the time I got handed off to Harley Curlis with Rick Reed's blessing, you know, I handed Harley a resume that I'd worked really hard on, not for helicopters or Army or anything, but, you know, at that point, I think I'd had 700 hours of tailwheel time. You know, I had a commercial CFI. I was working on my A&P. And I was trying to think of anything. I'd already taken the Illinois pesticide exams and anything I could think of to make it attractive to him, you know, and he couldn't. He looked at it and he's like, well, I don't know if there's any way I can say no to this.
Yep.
And yet I still had to load, you know, so, yep. So I did, you know, I didn't do two seasons or three seasons of loading. I still took my 6 weeks of summer time and I loaded. So I gave him whatever time I had. And I did load. And, you know, again, another topic, they call it paying your dues, but that's invaluable. And I probably could have benefited from more of it because I certainly probably don't know the loading and the sucky side of being on the ground as much as I should, but that was valuable time. Mm-hmm. And it definitely, if nothing else, it makes you appreciate what the ground guys are doing to support you getting in the air.
Right.
Anyway, so the preparation, that was the whole point of it is, you know, you can make sure that when you go talk to somebody, it's a yes, but it's up to you to prepare. And it was no small task. You know, I wasn't given anything. I worked a lot of years and made a lot of sacrifices to make sure that was going to be a guaranteed yes. Because the best days of my life, you got to remember, I'm like 35, 36 years old or something like that. I couldn't afford to have a no. I didn't have time for it to be a no.
And one thing I'd like to quickly point out too is you just said, you know, you're 35, 36 years old. That didn't somehow make you above doing that dirty part of the job, loading. I mean, you still had to do that to get in. And every once in a while, it's like, well, you know, I'm already at this age. I'm mature enough. I can, you know, I've got the tailwheel time, you know, throw me in, coach. But it's just not the case most of the time. So.
No, and the people that I talk to that call and say, hey, I'm looking for a job or whatever, I'm have a different perspective on it. Again, I don't refer to it as, well, you got to pay your dues and all that. I mean, that's kind of a peripheral, you know, spinoff from it. You do end up paying your dues, but that's not the point of it. The point of it is, you know, you're not like I did 2 years ago where all my loaders were on the road heading to another location. I got stuck loading myself. And it'd been long enough. I'm like, I had to FaceTime one of my loaders. I'm like, hey, show me which one of these handles I have to do to open it up because they're not labeled.
Right.
You know, and you feel like a complete dummy. Mm-hmm. So that was definitely some loader appreciation. You know, just stuff like that where you end up having to load yourself and ultimately you're responsible for what goes in your airplane and what quantities and most certainly what comes out of your airplane.
Right.
So that loading time is valuable. And, you know, it's not the point of it, but it certainly reveals some flaws in your character or your work ethic if you have any.
Right.
You know, it's not paying dues, but if you're too good or you fancy yourself, you know, too refined or skilled or professional to be getting dirty loading chemicals and dragging fuel hoses, you know, I tell guys pretty upfront, I'm like, this lifestyle is not going to be for you then.
Right.
Because there's a lot more of that than there is, a lot more of that than there is flying in the pretty air-conditioned airplane.
Right. From my experience so far, it seems like whatever your mentality is on the ground, and like you said, that mentality can refine over a couple of years, but whatever mentality you have when you switch from loading to flying in the plane, that's the mentality you fly with. That I'm above this goes to, well, I'm above spraying any field that's under 50 acres, et cetera, et cetera. I'm only doing this and I'm only doing dry work or I'm only doing that. And it doesn't work. You got to do everything.
And I've seen two kind of ag pilots, you know, because I'm fairly observative and I choose very closely, even to this day and age. There's still pilots out there, and I won't puff up their egos and tell them which ones I watch and emanate. But, you know, there's pilots I've seen that have done the hard work, and I understand it. And so when they get out of the airplane, even if they own the business, they get out of the airplane and they hook up the tow bar and they clean their windows. And, you know, I mean, they help tie it down, all that. And then there's the ones that crawl out of the airplane, grab their helmet and their paperwork and go in, you know, and throw the keys at the loaders to clean everything up and tie it down and prep it for the next day.
Yeah.
You know, I won't pretend to tell you which one is more desirable, both from an employer and an employee standpoint. And not to mention, you know, how much the one who helps put everything away and has some ownership of the ground operations, yeah. I mean, that guy is going to build a heck of a team for your organization.
Right. That was kind of the point that kind of got into my head there was just from a leadership perspective, making your employees feel a little bit more valuable. It seems like if your boss is willing to go and grab the garbage can and empty it because it's something that needs to be done, you know, from a young guy's perspective, it's like it just feels really good and motivates you to see your employer getting down and dirty with you, you know?
Yeah. So. Yeah. You know, that's one of the things is, you know, being a good leader, which again, whole other topic that I've taught for years and years and years is, you know, the guys that work for you, they need to know that you're willing. You can't ask them to do anything you're not willing to do. Which doesn't mean you have to do that. Doesn't mean you have to drag hoses and take out trash. It just means if there's the need, you can't be afraid to step in. Because the goodwill and the trust and loyalty and all that stuff that it brings, even if you don't end up owning the business, but just being a pilot in the organization, I mean, that bonds teams together like nothing else.
Right. So you ended up getting your own operation. Can you tell us a little bit about your operation that you have in Indiana?
Yeah, so it's, I got my 137 certificate, a couple years ago, which doing it all on your own, you know, that's quite a paperwork undertaking as well. And that was kind of a no fail because I had to have it. I was on a timeline. But we basically do about 70% potatoes and about 30% corn, you know, and a couple other little specialty crops, Northern Indiana and quite a lot of it in, Southern Michigan. But it's pretty simple, you know, there's lots of fungicides and insecticides and good amount of fertilizer and no herbicides or anything, you know, difficult. So it's a good place to kind of get your piece set into the industry, and it's fairly simple flying. I mean, the fields, as everyone knows in that part of the country, they're not big square 100-acre fields, you know. Yep. Some of them are shaped like your hand. Most of them are shaped like your hand. But it's good flying. 2 502s and a 402 and a geared ag cap. Anyway, it's good. Beautiful, beautiful place.
Are you into mentoring a lot of the younger guys in your operation?
Yeah, and I think you don't have a choice. You know, if you can't just be an ag pilot, because historically, most of the people that work in your operation and work with you, especially me, because I'm not a child, you know, I'm like 50.
Yep.
So everybody's going to be younger. And even though, like I said, I don't have 20 years flying ag, I know how to teach because I have a history and a background in that. So mm-hmm. I know how to teach. I kind of know how to mentor. And for one reason or another, basically because I have teenage boys myself, you know, and I had all the cadets at West Point and, you know, I've been an instructor pilot for years and civilian CFI and all that. So kind of have a background in teaching. So teaching and mentoring sort of come natural. And I've also done enough stupid stuff that I've got an entire library of things to tell people what not to do.
Right.
I think half of it's not telling them what to do. Half of it saying, hey, I did this and it was really stupid and it didn't work out.
Right.
But I didn't kill myself or bend an aircraft. So don't do that. Mm-hmm. So some of it is just that. And, you know, you have to have the correct temperament and attitude to teach people. Particularly something as dynamic as ag flying, which works very naturally. Cause I'm sort of used to teaching high risk flying and risk mitigation and stuff like that. So it makes sense to me and I enjoy it. I enjoy the type of flying and I have appreciation for the dangers and the dynamics of it. Anyway, but you gotta have the right temperament for it.
Right.
You can't teach at people, particularly this kind of flying. You know, you have to prep them ahead of time. Hey, this is what you're going to expect. And one of the worst things you can do as an operator or a teacher or a mentor is teach through failure. And by that, I mean, not give a guy all the information and then when they fail and come back and say, well, I knew that was going to happen and this was a valuable teaching lesson.
You're
that is not. In fact,
why. I've heard that.
Yeah.
Before.
And so And I will say at the risk of alienating myself from some of the industry, I mean, I'll say it out loud. Anybody who does that has no business teaching anybody. If you're going to do that, just be an ag pilot and go make your money and go home at the end of the day. Because one, that's dangerous. It completely deflates morale on whoever you're teaching. And it's just a jackass thing to do.
Yeah.
You know, you're basically sacrificing someone else's self-image and esteem, so you can bolster yours. So I'll say that out loud right now. And, you know, unapologetically, if it applies to you and it hurts your feelings, then, you know which category you're in.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and
that's the worst thing you can do to somebody. Is teach through failure.
I can kind of speak to experience from that. And I mean, you listen to my first episode, you have to say those things, because otherwise a guy could end up in the same situation as I kind of did my first year. And that's the mentor that I ended up happening. It was like, we were reacting to everything that was happening instead of being proactive. I guess that kind of goes back to how some people are taught though, you know, 40 years ago when they got in, it was just like, well, go do it. But it's just like, you know, through their own experience, it's like, well, that sucked, didn't it? Wasn't it horrible? Why are we carrying on the tradition? You know, why can't we be a little bit proactive? I mean, there's an awful lot at stake when somebody's being taught that way.
So like I said, that's a whole other podcast. I can go on about that for hours.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I'm going to do a podcast on my story on how I got started and where I'm at today. And I'm definitely going to dive into that. So what kind of mentor did you have when you were getting in? Was that your experience? Did you have somebody that was good at teaching you?
I was in a little bit different position in that I mean, I knew how to fly. I knew how to fly big tail with airplanes. I knew how to fly close to the ground. You know, I spent my life, you know, in the dark on night vision goggles in the mountains at 50 feet and dust clouds, that kind of stuff. So the high risk part of it was not necessarily a consideration. You know, it wasn't like taking a guy fresh out of college or an ag course or something like that and having to hand walk him through the industry. So I knew how to fly the airplane. I knew about planning for contingencies and all that. What I didn't know was the actual ag spring part. So I didn't go to an ag school, you know, it was kind of done in house. And I will tell you that Harley Curlis was a little bit hands off.
Okay.
But he knew what he was working with as well, you know, and he's a great mentor, extremely knowledgeable and patient. I won't go through the list of things that I screwed up, but I screwed up some pretty silly stuff that people would laugh at, you know, and if you know me, they'd be like, there's no way you were that dumb. Oh, I assure you I was that dumb. You know, I had several thousand hours of flying time and lots of heavy tailwheel time, but the ag portion of it, you know, was a learning curve. One, because I wasn't accustomed to single cockpit, you know, where you don't have anybody to talk to. And of course, none of the airplanes I flew had radios or anything, you know, and I didn't have a cell phone. I was sitting there texting on or be able to talk to anybody. So, you know, if I screwed something up, I had to figure out how to solve those problems by myself. There wasn't anybody to ask. And there was a whole host of things that I screwed up. But, you know, Harley endangered me to an appropriate number of hours spraying water in a place that, if I did screw something up, you know, it wasn't going to be catastrophic. But Harley was a good mentor in the fact that he knew what not to bother going over with, because he knew that I already understood it, you know, as far as operating the airplane.
Yep.
He and his general manager, Bobby Blickenstaff, as a matter of fact, spent more time with me explaining, you know, all the nuances of, hey, the different crops, this is what the chemicals are going to do to it. This is, you need to be aware of what's on the left and right of the field and all that kind of stuff. Not being a pilot, you know, Bobby was an extremely knowledgeable, basically agronomist and a manager. So he did as much mentorship, you know, as Harley did, which speaks a lot to him. And also, as a lesson to everyone else, is just because they're ground guys, don't discount what they're telling you, because they've been around the block, you know, several times, and they've got stuff to add as well.
Right.
So I won't say I kind of figured it out, a lot of it on my own, but I was able to do that because I didn't have to worry about flying the airplane necessarily. You know what I mean?
Right.
I wasn't worried about operating the aircraft. I was able to look outside the aircraft and focus on the ag part. So that being said, kind of a funny story is, now you got to remember, I've had at this point 10 or 11 combat deployments. You know, I've invaded countries. I've done stressful, like really stressful, high tempo, high threat stuff.
Yep.
And so I've been spraying water for like a month in this 301, and Harley just comes up to me one day and he's like, "Hey, go inside and get a map. You know, they're going to put some sneaky stuff in the hopper. You're going to have your first job." Mm-hmm. And immediately, I'm no kid. You know, I'm like 35 years old, and I turned white as a sheet. I'm like, "No, I'm not ready. I'm not ready." So, you know, to anybody else who thinks that they're immune to that, I will tell you, I would be the last person in the world that I would think would get nervous about that. But in the back of my mind, I'm like, all right, so all I've ever sprayed is water. This is real stuff. You know, I'm going to screw this field up. I'm going to get violated. You know, I'm going to cause, you know, Harley's going to get a call or it's going to get drift. Like all these things are going out of my head, kind of doubting where I was. But he was smart enough and confident enough to know that I could go do it. And one, like, no kidding, I'm like, I don't even know if I can find this field because I've been doing this 100-acre field at 3 miles from the airstrip, and now I got to go fly 10, 15 miles away and find this obscure cornfield somewhere.
Right.
You know, and little did I know that while I'm doing that, you know, Harley's up top 1,000 feet above me, flying around at 802 watching me. Mm-hmm. But I was so focused and nervous on this one little field that, you know, could have had a squadron of 802s above me, and I probably wouldn't have noticed.
Right.
So the one takeaway from that is I had all this experience. Like I said, I was more nervous diving into this field in day VFR, perfect conditions, no wind, in a 301. That first pass on the field, I was more nervous about the outcome of that than I was, no kidding, you know, invading foreign countries at night, you know, with surface-to-air missiles and RPGs and all that. Because, you know, as far as I'm concerned, this is it. This was my entire career hinged on this first pass. If I screwed it up, you know, all was going to be lost. That certainly wasn't the case. But mm-hmm. If a guy like me could be nervous about that, then, you know, I keep that in mind. I can't imagine what somebody with 500 hours or something like that is when you're trying to teach them and or put them in a turbine for their first time or send them out on their first revenue load. So
right.
I try and keep that in mind. But if it was that nerve wracking for me, you know, where's everyone else at with it? So that was a valuable experience. And I always use that. I tell guys that I'm like, "Hey, if you're nervous, that's all right. You just got to do the job, but it's all right to be nervous and concerned about it." Cause I certainly was.
You know, a good takeaway from that is that you can't listen to the chest thumpers. I'm glad you brought this topic up because I know I still go even to the national convention sometimes and hear the whole, "I ain't scared" spiel. And, you know, "I've done this and I've done that." You think it's all right to be nervous. I think, you know, you're aware of your vulnerabilities at that point, and that's a good thing because hopefully that means you're addressing them, correct?
Absolutely. You know, speaking from a guy who's flown and done high-risk stuff for their entire adult life, it's okay to be nervous. And we say nervous, but really what it is it's cautious and you're aware of the threats and the dangers of doing that, and that helps you mitigate them. It's not going to keep you from being a good or an aggressive or productive ag pilot. But it's going to keep you from doing stupid stuff that'll get you killed.
Right.
And I hate to say it. I mean, the PASS program and a lot of wise mentors, they go on for hours about it. But there's productive, and then there's doing what you think is productive. And for that extra 20 minutes a day that you're saving making hammerhead turns or you know, taxiing 20 miles an hour, thinking you're going to get more loads through the day and something like that, those are all things that somewhere down the road are going to bite you or bite somebody else. But it's okay to be nervous. I mean, everybody's nervous. You just got to, the productive ones take what you perceive as being nervous and they figure out how to channel it into being productive. Right. So not nervous. It's just cautious and it's aware of your surroundings.
Is there anything a topic that you wanted to address on here that we haven't talked about at all?
We see a lot on the social media about, there's a lot of guys that want to get in the industry and I still consider myself fairly new because I haven't been doing it for 20 years.
Yep.
I've been interested in it and looking from the outside for much of 20 years, but only in it, you know, for a total of about 9 or so. They talk about a shortage of pilots in the industry, and I think that is not correct. There is a shortage of good pilots that people want to work with in the industry. And one of the questions I had when I was new, and I would ask my mentors, you know, and it's pretty easy. You know, I'm like, I read Ag Air Updates and the NAAA magazine, and like, there's all these thousands hour ag pilots searching for jobs. I'm like, how am I going to get a job if these guys are looking for work? And very simply, you know, to a man, each one of them said, well, if they were that good, they'd have a job. Right. You know, there's a reason it's a $20,000 ag pilot who can't get hired. Mm-hmm. And I know it sounds completely judgmental and harsh, but again, if anybody knows me well enough, you know, that's not going to surprise them. Pretty upfront, straight shooter.
Yep.
And in the industry, there is always room for good personalities with solid work ethic. Mm-hmm. I mean, there just always is. Those guys always get hired, and I don't care if you're zero time.
Right.
You know, if you present yourself correctly and you got the right work ethic and you're willing to make some reasonable sacrifices to get that job, I mean, there is always room for you.
Right.
I'm mentoring a guy right now who doesn't have a ton of flight time, but his loyalty and his work ethic absolutely can't be beat. So I'm willing to dump the money into him, you know, and throw airplanes at him. I mean, he's probably the only aspiring ag pilot right now who has the keys to a Stearman and free gas as much as he can fly.
Right.
Because he's demonstrated the work ethic and, you know, the personality and the loyalty that make that an easy choice for me.
Right.
And do I necessarily have the time or the inclination or the need right now to bring a guy along like that? No, not really. But that's an investment, you know, in the business's future and my future and all that. So
right.
I guess that's to say that, you know, it's a worthy industry and there's always room for good guys. And if you're not a good guy at the, it's a self-diagnostic because you're going to have a hard time finding work. And, you know, and all the new ag pilot Facebook pages and all that, I don't think that most people realize how small and communicative the industry is. I mean, there is not – if I had a question about somebody, I can pick up the phone and I can call an operator that I know of, but I may not even be friends with him. And he and I will have a half-hour conversation about someone. So.
Yep.
You know, you can't ever think that you're slinking around in obscurity mm-hmm. anywhere in the industry, you know, because if you work for somebody even on the ground and you have a bad experience, and that goes both ways, either the operator's a bad experience or the employee's a bad experience. But if there's a bad experience to be had there, you know, word's going to get out. So
right.
particularly yeah. in Hegg Aviation, your first impression, you know, that you leave with your first employer, good or bad, that's going to carry you throughout your time in the industry.
Absolutely.
You know, and again, another topic, but when I left Harley broke me in and I owe him a ton. Mm-hmm. I owe him a ton, both for the opportunity, you know, monetarily, all kinds of stuff. And, the way I handled that was, you know, I could have done what I've seen several other times where you just leave a note on the door and say, hey, I'm going to a different operator, or you leave him a text or something equally impersonal and unprofessional.
Yep.
And you know, if somebody down the road had called Harley and said, hey, what do you think about this guy? He probably would have said something like, well, he's a good pilot and all that, but he completely screwed me and the way he left, you know, wasn't ideal and all that. And he would have been completely within his rights to do that. Mm-hmm. Because little known to new pilots is, you know, it takes about a good anywhere between $40,000 and $50,000 to break a guy in where I can let you loose on an entry-level piston ag plane for revenue.
Right.
You know, it's no small investment. Yeah. So, you know, you need to give a guy 4 or 5 years for him just to recoup that investment.
Yeah.
Anyway, Harley could have easily slammed me. But at that point, I had the maturity. You know, I literally had a sit-down conversation with him and said, hey, Harley, there's an opportunity in Indiana. This is what I want to do with my wife and my family. And I don't know that it's here. Would you allow me to go up and explore this? Yeah. And, you know, and of course he was disappointed, but I handled it in a way that to this day, you know, even though I left him, Harley and I have a great relationship and it's professional. And, you know, he and I helped him out when I could, down the road, I've helped him out with several things. And anyway, we talk monthly.
Yep.
But that could easily go on the other way, but that takes some maturity and professionalism.
Right.
So,
yeah.
Those are things that a lot of younger pilots don't understand.
Yeah. Just an example to further your point, even my current situation right now, well, I'll back up and add something else to another point you had is that I have a lot of friends that are my age that 4 years ago were not ag pilots and now they are. Their seats weren't advertised for. No one said, hey, I've got a Cessna. Hey, I've got a Pawnee. I want somebody to come fly it. That was never the case. You know, just adding to your point that somebody with work ethic and a good attitude, they create those seats almost. And in my situation right now, you know, my employer was, he did not have a second airplane when I called him. He was not looking for a pilot. I just cold called the guy and said, look, the situation I'm in, it's not good. I need to do something else. I know you don't have an airplane, but I was just wondering if you were interested in having a pilot. I'm looking for a job. And, you know, he made a substantial investment in a 402 for me to fly. And when he was looking at an airplane, he called me and he said, okay, I'm standing here looking at this airplane. Would you be willing to sign a piece of paper that says you'll work for me for 4 years so I don't lose my ass on this investment? And I said, absolutely, yes, I'd be willing to sign a piece of paper saying that. To this day, I haven't signed the piece of paper. Not because I didn't want to, but because he never presented it to me. And my point is that, you know, if you have a good reputation, which he does, if I were to turn around a week from now and say, sorry, I'm not coming to work this summer. I decided I wanted to stay home, or I decided I wanted to just go find that 6 week corn run position. I don't think I'd have another job in my home area, let alone anywhere else. And I, you know, that's, he hasn't told me that. Well, you know, if you leave, you won't have a job anywhere. That's just the unspoken truth of the situation, is that if I do to him, you know, if I screw him over, it isn't going to end well for me.
Well, and we all know, I mean, we all have, you know, non-compete contracts and, you know, employment contracts and stuff like that. But we all know they're, I hate to say it publicly, they're not worth anything. You know what I mean? Because for us to enforce them, you know, let's say you work for me and you leave 2 years, you know, as soon as you get your turbine time, you go to greener pastures. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going to cost me $15,000 to enforce that. Mm-hmm. And you don't have any money anyway, you know, so it's just more symbolic that you understand the investment we're putting into you.
Right.
Than it is really about keeping you there. You know, it's an invisible boundary and it's not going to keep you, and you're not going to think twice about it. It's more just letting you know, hey, this is what we have invested in you, and we need you to stick around. Right. But, you know, this is part of the discussions in the past program too, is part of that is your operator and you both communicating expectation management when you make that agreement as well.
Yeah.
And that doesn't get covered enough in the past program, you know, when they're talking to new people, because me, like everyone else, you know, like I will work for anyone flying any box crate anywhere in the country to get started. Mm-hmm. Like we all say that, and by and large, we'll all do that. But, you know, protecting yourself as a consumer, you know, you can paint yourself in a pretty bad corner, and find yourself very quickly realizing like, oh, I really don't want to work anywhere flying anything, because you'll fly junk for somebody that you don't really like working with or working for.
Yep.
In a place that you probably don't want to live. So there's some due diligence involved, even on the aspiring ag pilot, you know, your part, just because you owe it to yourself to get someplace that you want to be too. And if you find the right match early on, then it works out for everybody. You'll stay longer and you'll enjoy your workplace and the equipment you're flying and the environment you're working in. And your operator will very likely get his or her investment out of you, and you'll start breaking revenue for both of you.
Right. And that's exactly the stark difference, you know, what you said between the two places that I have flown, is that I was that guy. I was like, I will fly whatever, doing whatever to get into this job, and found out after one season that may or may not have been the best decision to make. But when I found my current employer, the expectations on both sides were very clear and both parties agreed on them. And it was just, I mean, the glove fits perfectly. And it was no question that this was going to work out fine. And it did. And I wish I had that. I wish I had that knowledge going into that first season, you know, because I definitely did not have the communication and expectations set when I got there and started flying my piston.
And I also figured out early, you know, because like every other operator, senior mentor in the industry, you know, I get, you know, 2-3 calls a month or Facebook messages or something like that. And I sort of figure it's my duty, because enough people went out of their way and helped me and said yes when they could have said no. So I always take time for it. You know, I have to say, hey, can you give me a day or two? I'm a little underwater right now. I'll get back to you. But I always take time to at least explain it to them, at least my view of how I see the world. And The current guy that I'm mentoring, who, you know, I don't know if he wants to remain anonymous or not, but, you know, his first airplane he'll fly, and we're going to break him in next season. He's going to start out flying a Turbine 502. That'll be the first ag plane he gets into. Mm-hmm. You know, and he understands that that's rare. But for a lot of economic reasons, we decided that was going to be the best choice for him. But I'm also spending an inordinate amount of time adequately preparing for him. We're not just taking a 400-hour guy and throwing him in a 502. Yep. He's going to have plenty of time, which fortunately I have the airplanes to prepare him to lead up to it. And also, you know, I'm pretty decent at explaining the ground school portion of it. So anyway, he'll be prepared. But he and I had a discussion when he came to me, because he's, you know, he's from the Southeast, and he did the All Work Anywhere to break into the industry. And I said, well, here's the deal. I said, here's what I'm going to tell you is, you say you'll work anywhere to break in, but here's what I know from my own personal experiences and watching others is that somehow instinctively, I don't know if it's our natural herd instinct or what, but as ag pilots, generally, we want to go home, wherever home is. You know, for me, it's Central Illinois or the Midwest, Iowa, Illinois, whatever. You know, you're from the Dakotas or Minnesota. So somehow, once we get it all sorted out, we get some skills, we all want to go home. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's generally speaking, but we're comfortable there. We all have somewhere daydreams in the back of our mind that we want to be an ag pilot back where we grew up and raise our families and all that kind of stuff. So like homing pigeons, you know, we're all eventually drawn to being home. And there's exceptions, you know, there's guys that are flying in places that they didn't grow up or near or whatever. But I knew from my own experience, I didn't want to end up in Florida or Louisiana or like rice country in California or something like that. It's just not, it wasn't what I was familiar with.
Yep.
You know, I grew up among row crops and corn and beans and stuff like that. And I know the area, and that's where I wanted to be. So that's how I made the decision of all the places I could have worked that I wanted to go back to Illinois, you know, and spray corn, be an ag pilot there. Mm-hmm. So I told this kid, I'm like, I went through all the economics. I said, I'm going to lay it out for you just so you understand and not to explode your 24-year-old brain. You know, so he was the same stage that you are now, yep, a little bit behind you. But, you know, I said, it's going to cost whatever, somewhere between $40,000 and $50,000. And here's the timeline it's going to take. You know, I need you to load for a season. And then I need you, because he's already had three seasons of loading for someone else. I said, I need you to load for a season. And then the next season, you know, you're going to load a little bit, but we're going to have you start flying an airplane, and you're not going to make any revenue flying, but you're going to be flying turbine practicing. And then your third season with me, you know, will be your first true revenue season. And that is not going to be, you know, you're not going to make $1 million,
right?
Because you're going to be doing all the low risk stuff, but you're no longer going to be dragging hoses. You know, you're going to be flying an airplane. So I set out the expectation for him as far as the timeline. And then economically, this is what you'd expect to earn. So buffer accordingly. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not time for you to go buy a new truck and a jet ski and get married and have a lot of kids. Yep. Which is a topic near and dear to George Parker's heart.
Yep.
You know, I said, so, I said, so, you know, these are your expectations. On the other hand, you know, I gave him, this is what I'm going to give you. And I didn't write it down, but we had a conversation. I said, and this is what I expect out of you. You know, to include, this is how much you're going to be loading. These are the licenses and stuff that I will facilitate and I'll pay for them, but I expect you to go get, to include, you know, and not everybody has the option to do this. I said, but here's the airplanes I have. I've got, you know, a really nice Cub. I've got a couple Stearmans. You know, we've got all this kind of stuff. I got a Cessna 185. I said, I will train you in it. I'm a CFI. I'll give you all your endorsements. But you know, here's the gas credit card and here's the airplane. And at this point, you need to have 700 legitimate hours. And I don't mean pencil whipping it, but I'm giving you free tailwheel airplanes and free gas. And so you had better come back with this amount of time, because this is what I need to insure you. Mm-hmm. You know, and in a testament to this guy, I mean, we get done at 8 o'clock at night, and I don't even barely pull myself out of the airplane. He'd been loading all day, but he gets in the airplane. You know, he's doing a half hour of pattern work until you can barely see outside. Then they push you in, and yep, you know, the next day, if we had a day off, he's up at 5 a.m, pulling the airplane out and flying, you know, banging around the pattern in it. So he took that opportunity for what it was. But part of that is I told him that whole speech about, hey, I know you want to go home, and he's from Florida. I said, so here's what you're going to do. That's going to screw both of us is if I do all this work, because I think it's an investment in the longevity and the prosperity of this company, because I think you're a good guy and you have solid work ethic. But if I put all this money and, more importantly, my time, you know, because if I'm putting all this time and energy into you, I'm not doing it with someone else who might stick around. You know, so I said, if you get your second season of turbine time and then decide, you know, I got a good job flying a 602 in Iowa somewhere, I'm like, you are going to completely screw me and the company over.
Yep.
You know, and not so much monetarily, but just now I got to go find someone else after I just invested 3 years in you. So
right.
We had a long discussion because I didn't ever want that to be the elephant in the room, you know, where, well, I didn't know. And, you know, so that was before he ever decided to move up and start loading for me. Mm-hmm. That was a discussion. So I think I checked all the boxes on that one, and he and I have a great partnership, and he understands, you know, I take care of him, I resource him, I pay for his NAAA membership, and I don't expect him to foot the bill for any of his training. But out of that, he knows that I expect, you know, just straight up linear loyalty.
Yep.
And the work ethic, we work well together. So that was a perfect fit for both of us. You know, and someday when I retire in 15 years or something like that, you know, if he doesn't screw it up, he'll end up with his own ag operation, and then he'll be in the point where he'll start bringing guys up and stuff like that. But
right.
Anyway, that was a long way around of there should be very clear, concise communication on what you're going to give the expiring ag pilot, what you expect of him, and then what can he expect of you? Because there's just volumes and volumes of guys like you, you know, you talk about you'll do anything to get in. And some operators are fairly predatory, you know, and they just see free labor and they'll dangle a carrot in front of you like, well, if you stick around for another season, I'll get a Pawnee, you know, and I've seen guys drag that out for 4 or 5 years. And then you just get a kid who's spent all his money on an ag school, is pissed off and doesn't have a seat. And then they just end up fading away and going to get a job to support their family.
Right.
And that's kind of tragic. So
yeah,
that's where the operators have the responsibility to communicate clearly. And, you know, if you're willing to invest time with me, then I'm willing to invest the effort with you.
Right. No, that's I'm glad we went there. That's an excellent example of mentor mentee relationship, operator, you know, aspiring egg pilot. Like, and just from the aspiring egg pilot's perspective going forward, the expectations with my current employer are, we had the exact same conversation that you are describing, and I have had no anxiety, no question. I know exactly what's going to happen every single year, and I'm not stressed about it. I'm not worried about it at all. You know, before the expectations, the future were not so clear, and it's kind of stressful especially when I was moving away from home. The sacrifice that I made was I was going to South Dakota for, you know, 5 hours away from home for 4 months. It wasn't always clear that was going to pan out, and that's kind of an anxiety promoting experience, I guess. I'm glad you gave that example of what it really should look like. And then for the guy that's trying to get into the industry, we're not always aware of how this business works. And somebody might cold call a guy and say, look, I'm willing to do anything to get into the industry. And you're absolutely right. Some people can be predatory about that, but we have, as an aspiring egg pilot, you have an obligation to kind of be weary, you know, don't be too naive. And that's kind of something that I want to point out, you know, be aware that is a possibility. You know, somebody might very well go, yeah, yep, dangle the carrot, just like you said.
Well, it's hard. I mean, I can say the same thing. It's really hard to listen with an objective ear and say, no, I'm not going to do that. Mm-hmm. When you're looking through an operator's window at a shiny air tractor or a thrush or something like that, and you're like, holy cow, someday I can have my hands on that.
Yep.
You know, you kind of get blinded by that. Mm-hmm. And I completely understand that, which why as operators and mentors or something like that, it's kind of our responsibility to even mentor, you know, how you're shaping expectations for somebody that comes through your door. Mm-hmm. Because not to be too idealistic about it, but the way we treat and teach guys like you and this guy that's working for me and how we do that, you know, that's positive or negative habit transfer. What you learn from us in 10 years is what you're going to do to some other guy who's, you know, who's in elementary school now, who's going to come up knocking on your door saying, hey, I want to be an ag pilot. So, you know, again, not to be too emotional about it, but there's a lot of responsibility involved because we're sort of shaping the next generation of ag pilots and people who are going to make the industry what it is or isn't. So that's a pretty heavy responsibility. We forget about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think we kind of got it all. I guess we're at about an hour and 20 minutes. Is there anything else that you want to talk about? We've got my list covered, so.
I will just leave with, you know, I'm not making it up, and I'm not saying it for the benefit of the industry when I tell guys I have flown some of the coolest aircraft and missions, you know, that there is to be had, both fixed wing and helicopters, and I wouldn't trade this occupation for anything. It is absolutely the best flying job and the best people that I've ever been around. So it wasn't an accident, you know, getting into ag aviation wasn't a consolation prize or something else I couldn't get done. Cause I'm pretty sure I could go do pretty much whatever I wanted. And this is what I chose. And I have absolutely no regrets or reservations. It's the best flying and the best industry as far as aviation I've ever been associated with. So if you get frustrated or you think it's not worth it or whatever, I guarantee that it is. You know, and unfortunately, if you find yourself not being favored or having a rough time, you know, it's not the industry. It's trying to look a little bit inward because it's something you're doing wrong. Because I've never seen good people not get hired or not be employed or not welcomed with open arms in the industry. It's definitely a self-filtering, self-diagnostic if it's not working for you.
Right.
Because it's everything that I thought it would be and more. So I thoroughly enjoy it, and I hope to do it until I can't physically do it anymore, and then I'm happy to turn the reins over to someone else.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Mike, for taking the time to sit down with me. I really appreciate it.
No, that was a good time.
Well, thanks, everybody, for checking out the Ag Aviator podcast. I hope everybody that's getting into the industry can take something away from that. It was great having Mike on the show. If you want to keep up with what's going on with the podcast, head on over to Instagram, follow me at Valley Ag Pilot, or on Facebook as the Valley Ag Pilot. Thanks again, everybody, for checking out the show. Hope everybody's doing well out there. We will talk to you next time.